why is it that when people give a statement to say that Martin Bormann was certainly here, he lived at that address. I mean, come on, Mengele was here. Karl Wernert was here. Adolf Eichmann was here. Klaus Barbie was here. I mean, how many need to be here, but the money man's not here?
So, it's Friday afternoon. Welcome to the BCFM Online Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news is prospective parliamentary candidate for Bristol West, James Cox. Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers is here too. In the second hour, Trump says he's had enough negotiating with China. Can he say that? And why might it matter? Also, the FBI released the name of a top Saudi intelligence official in Washington who helped the 9/11 hijackers while they were preparing to attack the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. We all know bin Laden was a Saudi, but is this the Saudi government in an act of war against the USA? Why might they have released this now, and was it really an accident? Also, a nanotech vaccine for COVID-19, according to Whitney Webb. How? And when will it come? What will be in the concoction injected into us? Will it be an ordinary vaccine? If it's made by Bill Gates, DARPA and the Department of Defense, is there any truth to these stories? Also, we review two books, Jeffrey Robinson's Merger, How Organized Crime is Taking Over the World, and Christians Being Censored in the US, James Perloff's Truth is a Lonely Warrior. We hear from him about the idea of a major crisis being a Kissinger-esque push for a world government, and whether that might actually be a good idea. Also, work on the end times prophecies. Perloff thinks we may be seeing a war in heaven unfolding down here before our eyes. That's all in the second hour. And joining us, though, to review this week's news, it's prospective parliamentary candidate for Bristol West, James Cox. Hi, James, and welcome to the Politics Show.
Hi, Tony. How are you?
Very well. I think we should probably start, though, by talking about the delay to the elections. Is this something that you understand, you support? Because really it's given Bristol's Mayor Marvin Rees, from the Labour Party, a free pass for a year.
Yeah, I think given the sort of unprecedented situation that we were in, it made sense to delay it by about a year, given that we don't know the full extent of the reach of the virus yet and if it's going to come back. And obviously, we want as many people to participate in the democratic process as possible. I'm concerned that we are now, that the mayor and the Labour Party are now acting beyond their mandate given to them in the last election. And I would hope that the mayor will use this year to try and really create consensus within the council house and not run it as a Marvin Rees Labour Party administration, but more a rainbow administration, trying to get in as many people as possible for this one extra year that he's been given. I won't hold my breath, but I think that would be the mature, sensible and right thing to do, given the circumstances.
Well, I mean, this is the platform that Marvin Rees started on was with a kind of a rainbow cabinet, and he did originally have that. Martin, do you think there's any prospect? Why should Marvin Rees include anyone from other parties in his cabinet?
Well, as you know, he inherited a rainbow cabinet from George Ferguson, and he ultimately then moved towards
Because, Martin, it wasn't just inherited, was it? He actually set that out in his stall for his manifesto.
Yeah, he did, and then
he
reverted, if you like, to what's normal in other major cities in the country, which is a party political administration. So he's not doing anything different from Andy Burnham in Manchester or Sadiq Khan in London.
No, but the point is, he is doing something different to what he was actually elected to do in 2016.
Yes, and the electorate will have their view on that when it comes to the ballot box when the election's finally called. I personally was quite unhappy with the Labour Party going into coalition with Ferguson, but when it happened, I then reconciled myself to it. And then, of course, we then got Marvin Rees decided he was going to continue with the same kind of setup. But it's within his powers, as laid down by the Conservative government who created mayors, and I'm not someone who's in favour of mayors, that they can do pretty much what they like. That's the whole idea of having them. I don't agree with it, but that's it. That's what it's about.
Also, Martin, before we go back to James, there is this whole business of top pay. In Marvin Rees's, this is not 4 years ago, but this is his April 29, 2019 re-election statement. He actually says in there he's reducing City Hall senior management and freezing top pay. So he's not doing that, is he? He's actually increasing his own pay by something like 12.5% at a time when many other people in politics, because of all these measures that are taking and the hardship being suffered, are actually reducing their pay. So that does seem like he's actually not doing what he said even just a year ago.
Well, you'll have to ask him about that, Tony. I don't know exactly what policies he's pursuing.
Well, it would be lovely. I'd love to ask him, Martin.
Well, I know.
I'm
not in a position to defend that. I don't know enough about it to have a strong opinion, to be honest with you.
All right. James, what do you make of the mayor's 12.5% pay rise? He's giving himself a £9,000 extra as of the beginning of this next financial year, I think.
Well, I think there are a number of sort of different aspects within that, within the events of what's happened. I mean, this wasn't Marvin saying I'm going to have 12.5%, I'm going to give myself an extra 12.5% pay rise. This was an independent body. And as far as I'm aware, it's all above board. And what I think is quite unfortunate and maybe shows a bit of a lack of political awareness is the timing of all this coming out when not only are we going through a massive crisis with COVID-19, but also that it's looking that like local authorities are going to be even more burdened going into the next few years. So I think, you know, nobody likes it when politicians get pay rises. I'm going to be one of the unpopular ones and say I think most politicians do earn their pay. Some very famously don't. And it's, I think, meant that there is a atmosphere of distrust between the public and politicians in many cases. But it is a job. It is a tough job and they should get paid, I think, a fair wage for it. What that fair wage is, I'm not in a position to say, and that's why I think it's important that it stays under the purview of independent commissions.
I mean, the idea now is that politicians seem to be being, there seems to be this sort of idea around, particularly coming from people like Business West, that, you know, politicians have got a right to be paid the same as, same sort of levels as an equivalent in the private sector.
Well, what would the equivalent be in that? I think it's a very difficult balancing act to make because you want people who are obviously there because their primary motivation is public service, not financial gain. But in order to, I think, get the most talented people in, you do have to ensure that there is the right compensation. But having said that, I look at the salary of councillors and I think that perhaps the mayor should have resisted the pay rise for himself in his one role and made sure that councillors are actually paid a decent amount so that I'm of the opinion that being a councillor should be, in many cases, a full-time job because of the barrier that it creates to people who can't afford to take that time off from work to be a councillor and to represent their communities. So I think, you know, it is always going to be a tough conversation to have of how much should a politician get paid. But I don't think it should be in the same remit as those in the private sector.
Okay. Marvin Rees has called, you touched on this, James, has called for £90 million from central government to cover some of the costs, not even all of the costs, of the pandemic here in Bristol. He doesn't seem to be being listened to by Westminster.
No, and we have seen, I think, you know, even over the last 10 years or so, we've seen funding, central government funding to local authorities being reduced and reduced and reduced. Obviously, with this pandemic, there is now a much greater need on local authorities to take more direct action. So I think he's absolutely right in making the call for that £90 million. He should even perhaps go further. But I think what people in Bristol and perhaps even people in the government would have more confidence in is if we were assured that over the next year, Marvin wasn't going to be given basically free rein to spend this money on whatever he wanted, with some of the vanity projects that have been suggested in the past. and that this £90 million is given to those services, whether it be helping those disadvantaged in schools who've been put at a who've been put at more of a disadvantage because of this, giving more money to our adult social care needs, not on things like a an underground for Bristol.
Now, before we get into have a listen to some of the Prime Minister's questions this week, I thought it'd be, you know, helpful just to give Martin and James, Martin from the Labour Party and James from the Lib Dems, just a couple of minutes or a minute maybe to give us their take on the pandemic and particularly on the response and the at the moment the attempt it seems by Boris and Westminster to slowly come out of this lockdown. So maybe you first, James Cox from the Lib Dems. What do you think of the response to the pandemic and now the preparations to end the lockdown?
I think the response was perhaps a bit too slow, particularly on things like testing, when we were constantly assured that it was going to happen in these hundreds of thousands of numbers that just never materialised. It has, I think, exposed the great disparity of preparation and wealth in this country, and the fact that, you know, there are so many people for whom losing 20% of their pay is the difference between being able to pay their rent or not, being able to pay their mortgage or not. I think going forward, any suggestion that there is going to be a tapering off of the lockdown has to be not only rigorously within the evidence of the science shown, but we as the public should be able to scrutinise that evidence that's being presented. But I think if the government needs to absolutely do one thing, it is be clear and consistent with its messaging and make sure that there's none of this sort of two messages going on at once, that you can go to work, that you can't go to work, or you can use public transport, but don't use public transport. Make sure that you are being clear and consistent with people so that they follow the rules and they do what is best in the need of public health.
Martin, what's your thoughts on the, I mean, this is a, basically like a kind of tidal wave of a germ arriving in Britain. The government's got to do something about it. What do you think of their response and the way they're now trying to restore the economy?
Well, I broadly agree with what's just been said, although I'm probably a bit stronger. I think the decision not to test at the early stages and that we were going to go for a herd immunity strategy will, with hindsight, be seen to be absolutely wrong. And, of course, the government itself admits now that they shouldn't have done that. But, of course, that probably largely explains the fact that we're a huge number of deaths that we've had. And I think the also, of course, the lockdown advice on Sunday from Boris Johnson was absolutely confusing and totally wrong. And basically, they shouldn't have. You can't have a lockdown until you've got a testing regime in place. We haven't got a testing regime, and that's why they didn't want to pursue testing, because they didn't have the capacity to do.
Martin, surely the idea was that you have a lockdown until you've got a testing regime in place, and they now have.
Well, they haven't. That's the problem, and they haven't had one. We've now got community transmission. If you look at New Zealand and South Korea and places that have and Kerala in southern India, they basically stopped everybody coming into the country and tested everybody, so they're able to chase down individual community transmissions. We're nowhere near that in this country, but pressure to open the economy up, as other countries now, like New Zealand, are opening up, we can't do that because we didn't do the right stuff at the beginning. We left the stable door open, the horse bolted, the horse is still running around the field, and we're now saying we're going to move to stage two when we're not in a position to do so. And of course, ultimately, this will have dramatic both health and economic effects. And hopefully, people will draw the relevant conclusions about the competence of the government.
The Swedish epidemiologist who's behind their lockdown, Johan Giesecke, he's pointed particularly to care homes as being a massive failure here. He said that the hard lockdown, they've got what they call a soft lockdown. It's a bit like hard and soft Brexit, I suppose. The hard lockdown we've got here, he said, was designed to protect people in care homes, but it's completely failed to do that.
Well, the reason, if you're asking me about that, the reason for that is that they were trying to protect the NHS, So they were clearing people out of the NHS hospitals and sending them to care homes. This has always been a problem. The marriage between social care and national health has been a major problem for years. I would argue, as Andy Burnham argues, that social care should be part of the National Health Service so that it isn't basically funded through a different stream, through local authorities, etc. And the mismanagement of our health service over many years and the social care services are being cruelly exposed by this crisis.
James, what do you think about the care homes particularly?
I mean, it's absolutely tragic. Of course, I think the ONS figure showed it was about 40% of infections now coming from care homes. I just wanted to touch on Martin's point about bringing social care into the NHS. I think he's absolutely right. This has long been a political football that's been kicked around for too long. And everyone talks about we need to find a solution to the crisis. We need to find a solution to the crisis. But we've been talking about that for about 10, 15 years at least. So I think bringing social care into the National Health Service and creating a National Health and Care Service where you have one funding stream, everyone can talk to each other. It's not run by disparate local authorities, each with different policies and each part privatising this and part privatising that, is absolutely vital. I'm currently staying with my partner and her mother is a care worker. She's been on very difficult 12-hour shifts. And so it has sort of given a really, I think, dire reflection on what is currently going on in care homes. Because, it's difficult to social distance. Anyway, it's difficult to ensure that people are continually washing their hands, being mindful, etc., etc. When you're doing that with people in care homes, when you're doing that with people who might be suffering from dementia, might be suffering from other issues with mental ill health, you really are making it difficult. And when you're not supplying care homes with the right PPE, the personal protective equipment, then you're making that job not only for carers, but for those within the care homes even more difficult. So I think the issue around care homes is the ultimate national scandal that will come out of this if the government and when the government answers the Liberal Democrats' calls for an inquiry into what decisions were made and on what evidence they were made from.
Okay, well, it's all very well to talk about inquiries, but what about now? What should they do now, James?
Well, we absolutely see an increase in testing and personal protective equipment, particularly in care homes. At the moment, from what I gather, my would-be mother-in-law has just been tested about a week ago, and she's still not had her result back. A week ago. And she's still going into work, still doing these 12-hour shifts. Yes, she's in PPE, and there are all sorts of measures going in there. But it's still not good enough to know that she could be carrying the virus and still going into work because she has to be there to help people.
Amazing. I mean, Johan Giesecke, I mentioned this epidemiologist, he's one of the top in the world. He's part of the World Health Organization, although he does disagree with some of their policies. He's penned a letter to The Lancet, the medical paper, which was published this week, and it's called The Invisible Pandemic. This is, I suppose, one of the key things about this is that it is being passed around without anybody realising it. Measures to flatten the curve, he says, might have an effect, but a lockdown only pushes the severe cases into the future. It will not prevent them, he says. Admittedly, countries have managed to slow down the spread so as not to overburden the healthcare systems, and yes, effective drugs that save lives might soon be developed. But this pandemic is swift, and those drugs have to be developed, tested and marketed quickly. Much hope is put in vaccines, but they will take time. And with the unclear protective immunological response to infection, it is not certain that vaccines can be very effective. I mean, this is the Swedes are now saying that they are not really going to be exposed to any kind of second wave because it's something like 50% of their population now has had this without any mass testing, Martin. I mean, obviously, testing is important for those who are more vulnerable. There are various aspects of this that have been sort of coming out this week. One is the Nightingale hospitals, which were almost entirely empty. The same situation, by the way, in the United States, where all enormous medical facilities were created. There's one in London which actually had a maximum of only 20 patients in 4,000 intensive care beds. So And the result has been that many, many people have been pushed out from healthcare that they would have been getting normally. But you first, Martin, can you address this whole issue of the preparedness of the NHS for an enormous pandemic that never actually arrived, and the suffering that's now going on because of that? Many people with getting routine doctor's visits, surgery, etc., and treatment from the NHS have not been getting it. Perhaps this is why more people have been dying.
Well, can I just, first of all, agree that we should have an inquiry into all of this. I think it's quite important that the government understands that there is going to be a public inquiry into this, just as there was into the Iraq war. And, of course, the Blair government resisted that, but ultimately they were forced to have one. It should be absolutely top of the agenda that we're going to go back over this.
I mean, Martin, and look at all of these decisions. Inquiries now, the terms of reference of them are set by ministers, not by judges.
I agree that there's a question about whether British inquiries are adequate, because the 2005 Inquiries Act, you know, it gives far too much power to the executive in creating the terms of the inquiry. But I think it's absolutely legitimate for mainstream politicians, you know, people who are in the political class, if you like, to be saying absolutely clearly that we're going to have a fully independent inquiry into every aspect of this, because, of course, there have been bad decisions at every stage, and probably some good decisions as well, which we should also look at what went well as what went badly. But I think the government of the day has got to understand that as they make their decisions, they are going to be held to account in the end for what they do.
Okay, but can because you come back to the point, which is by the Swedish epidemiologist's point, Martin. The Swedish epidemiologist's point is that the real pandemic is invisible. It's been going on beneath the surface, and he says it's probably at its peak now in many European countries.
One of the problems we've got, Tony, is that it may be, unlike flu, people don't develop immunity through being exposed to it. It's not clear that they do.
Well, he said in Sweden they haven't had a single case of reinfection.
Well, that's okay. If that's the case, that's good. I mean, we can all breathe a sigh of relief. And that means that ultimately, quickly or slowly, the pandemic has to run through the population of the world, not just of Sweden. Think about countries like India and so on, and you'll see how potentially catastrophic this is going to be. The Swedish policy, we will see in the long run, when we look back, who made the right decisions and who didn't make the right decisions. Places like New Zealand and Kerala, which have done very well, have completely wiped out the virus, certainly didn't pursue a Swedish-style policy.
No, they didn't. Cape Cod Hospital also has closed without seeing any coronavirus patients at all. These are the emergency hospitals that have been opened, James.
Yes, at the time, I think we were all very supportive of them because it felt like they were very much going to be in use. What I worry about is the knock-on effects that COVID has had on other aspects of the public's health. So we've seen a drop in hospital admissions, in A&E admissions, people going to see their GP, and that will ultimately, from a physical and mental health point of view, have a huge effect on the nation's health outside of COVID. So I don't know how possible this would have been, but what I would have liked to have seen is these Nightingale hospitals, could even use it better now. Those with or suspect of the symptoms of COVID-19 being directed towards these centres so they can be properly treated and properly monitored and properly sort of tested and all the rest of it there, so that people can still have confidence that they can go and visit their GP and, you know, with whatever health ailment they may have, or they can go to A&E if they need to go to A&E, and they can go to hospital for those appointments that have been booked and have the confidence that they're not going to pick up COVID because there won't be any trace of it there. I mean, that for me would be an ideal situation. How possible that is to implement is another question. But I think it's unfortunate that these hospitals that were so lauded as, you know, this is the nation getting its act together, this is us showing that we can do what other countries can do and build a hospital in 9 days, to then not use them and have this mass resource just sort of sat there, I think is a bit of a wasted opportunity given the circumstances.
Well, Martin, just coming back to you about Sweden, David Davis has pointed out, the Tory MP, he's saying it's a bigger issue than Professor Ferguson's private life, which is one of the reasons that he was sacked. I mean, he's the scientist behind the lockdown from Imperial College. David Davis says is the accuracy of his model. How accurate is his model? David Davis says when applied to the Swedish policy, the Ferguson Imperial College model forecasts 40,000 deaths by now. It's actually over 15 times what the real amount of, has been with their soft lockdown. So, I mean, there was an opportunity given to the British as well to have a soft lockdown, that is to say, to find the most vulnerable people, for them to lock down, and for younger, less vulnerable people, children, for example, to catch this. He's saying the actual, it's 15 times the real number were predicted by Ferguson to what actually happened in Sweden. So his models don't seem to be really very much use.
Well, I think that's where an inquiry comes in, Tony. We look at every aspect of this, the political response and the scientific response. Was it correct? Was it not correct? I think that's the real test. And of course, what's actually happened in Norway and Finland is they've had much lower deaths than in Sweden. And they are comparable countries. Don't forget, Sweden is not, like Britain, a major hub for transport. Yeah, we've got people flying through Heathrow, going everywhere. And, you know, we're much more exposed to the outside world. We're global Britain. Sweden, New Zealand, Kerala, and other countries which have done rather better than we have, don't forget, they don't get quite as much traffic as we do. But what we could have done, and should have done probably, is shut down in people coming into the country, or at least make sure we tested them and put them into quarantine. But we didn't do that.
Another COVID-19 related story. We just hear this morning that the Royal Mail's chief executive, Rico Black, has been sacked. Well, I mean, he's probably say he's resigned from the Royal Mail. I saw on YouTube this morning pictures of Royal Mail staff in sorting offices cheering, shouting and jumping around and dancing that Rico Black has finally been sacked. But, I mean, this is as a result of apparently the post office have just failed to react well to this. In other words, that there's a lot more reliance on stuff going by mail order because, you know, obviously many retail outlets have closed. But, James, apparently the Royal Mail has not really taken advantage of this within the rules that it's allowed to, using social distancing at post offices. I've been into post offices myself. But that he has decided that they should have much limited hours. That means that they sometimes have to close with big queues outside. And now he's gone. Rico Black is no more chief executive of Royal Mail.
Well, without knowing too much about the situation, I think, you know, the Royal Mail does have an important role to play within the general COVID response. Because as you absolutely rightly say, a lot more people who are still buying and sort of using the economy will be doing that over postage. And it's absolutely necessary for them to have, for them to do that. But as I say, without knowing too much about the situation, it's really hard to comment.
Well, I'll tell you what I'll do is I'll post up a link to the video of the sorting office workers cheering and shouting. But Martin, this is it's a sort of company which is floated towards the private sector by, I believe it was the last Labour government, and simply haven't done it. Anyway, sorry, carry on.
Well, I mean, it was our Liberal Democrat colleague, what's his name now?
Vince Cable.
Against the advice of the Communication Workers Union. Well, obviously, one of the problems with moving to a kind of postal-based economy, which is effectively what's happened, is that in the warehouses and sorting offices, they're potentially COVID traps. And that means, of course, the packaging could be carrying COVID. So we've shifted from, you know, physical shopping to online shopping, but that then means that people, you know, people working in meat packing facilities all over the world, they are basically, you know, they are slaughterhouses. But if you don't have adequate social distancing in those slaughterhouses, then they are going to be spreading the disease that is going to be delivered to your door.
Okay, I mean, I do know a little bit about what's been going on in the Royal Mail, and they're very scrupulous. They have regular washing, they have gloves and all that sort of thing. So, and the World Health Organization has said that this is a month or so ago, that with these basic measures in the postal system, that you can't catch the virus from a package, because if you have a few basic ideas, like obviously, you know, the social distancing going on within the sorting office and wearing of gloves, all that sort of thing, the idea is that a letter takes a couple of days anyway to go from A to B, and as it goes through the system, with these measures in place, it should never be a route of transmission. And that is what the post office has been doing. But the main point here, really, Martin, is that the restriction on the hours and all these sorts of things that's been going on in the post office has meant that the chief executive has been sacked.
Well, presumably because the shareholders are losing money, if that's the reason he's been sacked. I mean, incidentally, of course, the post office has to compete against the private sector. Are they pursuing the same stringent standards as the post office? Because if they're not, then the whole thing's a waste of time anyway, because people are going to pay for cheaper delivery from eBay or whatever. And are they going to be doing all of this? This is the problem with having a fragmented, privatized economy. You haven't got the capacity to make overall plans, which, of course, we did have during World War II and in the subsequent years, but we gradually, over the decades, got rid of it. And then, of course, something like this comes along and reminds you why our grandparents in the 1940s weren't entirely stupid to nationalise an awful big section of the economy.
OK, so we're going to have a listen now to go over to the United States. We were talking there about the effectively white elephant hospitals that were created for the pandemic wave of very sick patients that didn't actually come. Well, obviously, lots of people have died, nowhere near as many as predicted. But here's a New York City doctor who claims that COVID-19 is not what they say. He says that he's been working on patients and literally at the front line, and he is not actually seeing the symptoms that we're being told are the symptoms. And this is, I suppose, part of this whole idea of it's being a novel coronavirus. It's not a normal common cold. It does very different things to the body. So let's have a listen to him now.
This is Dr. Cameron Kyle Seidel, ER and critical care doctor from New York City. 9 days ago, I opened an intensive care unit to care for the sickest COVID-positive patients in the city. In these 9 days, I have seen things I have never seen before. In treating these patients, I have witnessed medical phenomena that just don't make sense in the context of treating a disease that is supposed to be a viral pneumonia. 9 days ago, I presumed I was opening an intensive care unit to treat patients with a virus causing a pneumonia that was ravaging lungs across the world, starting out as something mild, a cough, a sore throat, and progressively increasing in severity until ultimately ending in something called acute respiratory distress syndrome, or ARDS. This is the paradigm that every hospital in the country is working under. This is the disease, ARDS, that every hospital is preparing to treat. And this is the disease, ARDS, for which in the next 2 to 6 weeks, 100,000 Americans might be put on a ventilator. And yet, everything I've seen in the last 9 days, all the things that just don't make sense, the patients I'm seeing in front of me, the lungs I'm trying to improve, have led me to believe that COVID-19 is not this disease, and that we are operating under a medical paradigm that is untrue. In short, I believe we are treating the wrong disease, and I fear that this misguided treatment will lead to a tremendous amount of harm to a great number of people in a very short time. As New York City appears to be about 10 days ahead of the country, I feel compelled to get this information out. COVID-19 lung disease, as far as I can see, is not a pneumonia and should not be treated as one. Rather, it appears as some kind of viral-induced disease, most resembling high-altitude sickness. It is as if tens of thousands of my fellow New Yorkers are on a plane at 30,000 feet and the cabin pressure is slowly being let out. These patients are slowly being starved of oxygen. I have seen patients dependent on oxygen take off their oxygen and quickly progress through a state of anxiety and emotional distress and eventually get blue in the face. And while they look like patients absolutely on the brink of death, they do not look like patients dying of pneumonia. I have never been a mountain climber, and I do not know the conditions at base camp below the highest peaks in the world, but I suspect that the patients I'm seeing in front of me look most like as if a person was dropped off on the top of Mount Everest without time to acclimate. I don't know the final answer of this disease, but I'm quite sure that a ventilator is not it. That is not to say that we don't need ventilators. We absolutely need them. They are the only way at this time that we are able to give a little more oxygen to patients who need it. But when we treat people with ARDS, we typically use ventilators to treat what's called respiratory failure. That is, we use the ventilator to do the work that the patient's muscles can no longer do because they're too tired to do it. These patients' muscles work fine. I fear that if we're using a false paradigm to treat a new disease, that the method that we program the ventilator, one based on a notion of respiratory failure as opposed to oxygen failure, that this method, and there are a great many number of methods we can use with the ventilator, but this method being widely adopted at this very moment in every hospital in the country, which aims to increase pressure on the lungs in order to open them up, is actually doing more harm than good, and that the pressure we are providing to lungs, we may be providing to lungs that cannot stand it, that cannot take it, and that the ARDS that we are seeing, that the whole world is seeing, may be nothing more than lung injury caused by the ventilator. Now, I don't know the final answer to this disease. I do sense that we will have to use ventilators. We will have to use a great many number of ventilators, and we need a great many number of ventilators, but I sense that we can use them in a much safer way. In a much safer method. That safer method challenges long-held dogmatic beliefs within the medical community and among lung specialists, which will not be easy to overcome. But I really believe that they must be overcome. There are hundreds of thousands of lungs in this country at risk, and the time to overcome them is now. I'm confident that if those of us that work bedside with these patients, those of us who are witnessing the things that we have never seen before, despite the many years we have worked and the thousands of patients and diseases we have seen, if we can effectively communicate this to all those that are so important but who are not bedside, the researchers, the administrators, those who procure our resources and make our protocols, the politicians, our own governments, if we are able to convince them that this is a disease that is different than anything we have ever seen, I am confident that an answer can be found, that effective treatments can be discovered, and that a plan to disseminate that treatment can be rapidly deployed, and that tens of thousands and probably hundreds of thousands of lives and lungs will be protected. The time for this is now. We are staring into a future in which a great many of our fellow Americans are going to suffer, not to mention people all around the world. For those of who will not suffer directly from this disease, from the terrible human cost of this disease, for those who will not lose a family member or a friend, and there will be a great many number of people who will lose those close to them, but for those who don't, they are still going to suffer from the great economic cost of COVID-19. We are all involved in this future. So I urge you, for those of us, if you are out there, for those who work bedside, I urge you to speak up. We can change this. I thank you all for listening. Please spread the message and stay safe.
Now, I suppose I should apologize. That is quite a long clip, but I just thought the guy is so articulate, really. And it's almost like, you know, every now and again, you need to hear from the coalface. So that was Cameron Colford, medical doctor from New York. James, I suppose the main thing he's saying there is that because of this being a very new type of virus, the prescribed treatment for patients isn't necessarily working. He even goes so far as to say that ventilators could be injuring people.
I think he raises a number of important points, that it is an evolving disease. This is a evolving situation, which is new. We don't know a lot about it. Our understanding of it, and I think science's understanding of it, is changing day by day as we are more exposed to it. And also the way that it presents differently in different people. There aren't a subscribed list of definite symptoms. Some people get one of them, some people get two of them, some people get both, some people get neither. So I think what he's saying is an important addition to the debate, but we need to look at it around the what I like to think of as the consensus context, and the decisions, particularly public health decisions, public policy decisions, cannot be made based on just one person's view on the field. As valuable as that view is, and important as that view is to the debate, and it is vital, I think, that his comments and his observations are looked at importantly. But I think the best thing to do to keep people safe from the government's point of view is ensure that people trust the scientific advice. And that the decisions that they are making are based on scientific advice, not political reasons.
Okay, so the medical scientific advice is one thing, but I mean, we've had Professor Ferguson actually removed because it didn't look as if he even trusted his own lockdown advice, the scientific advice that he gave the government.
Yeah, I mean, the Professor Ferguson case, I don't really care what happens in his private life, but when you go on national television and say, for your own public health, do not do this, and then are caught doing that, it does undermine trust in the scientific, within the medical evidence. And I think that's absolutely what the government should be trying to avoid at all costs, because the moment that we start thinking, actually, we can't trust the scientists who are supposed to be advising the government on what to do next, given the unprecedented situation that they're in, and that there are so many unknown factors at play. The moment we do that, then anything's possible.
Okay, so I think, Martin, can we just hear from Martin now? What do you make of this whole idea that from the top, this Dr. Cameron Colford in New York is saying he thinks that there may have been a basic misdiagnosis here, that people are kind of going with what they were expecting to find, not what he is seeing as the disease is actually producing in people. I know a few weeks ago you mentioned this whole idea of a cytokine storm, I think it is, was going on in the lungs, where the immune system was over-responding, and this is not the same as pneumonia.
No, it's not. I think a lot of the problems have come because everybody's presumed that this is just a form of flu, and it's increasingly clear that perhaps it isn't, and that there may be people who recover, for example, there are long-term damages to internal organs. And of course, they've now discovered that some children are showing these very rare forms of pathology, which seems to be linked to COVID infection, which has nothing to do with lungs. And incidentally, I was in a park some weeks ago and I saw a young woman in her 20s taken away by ambulance staff. And she was basically fainting, but she wasn't, she was breathing perfectly normally. And I think this is the problem, is that people who are breathing normally, they're still having, it's basically like altitude sickness. As the doctor suggested. And she was saying to the staff as they were taking her away, why have you got this thing stuck in my arm? And they're saying, well, we're just checking your oxygen level, because she was conscious and she was talking and she wasn't having trouble breathing. That's just anecdotal. I think the real take home for me of this is, because we don't know what it is, we should err on the side of caution when it comes to things like releasing lockdowns. I think the decision to release the lockdown in England on Sunday was wrong. And I think time will show that it was the wrong decision.
What they're doing in Wales, and we'll be hearing about that in a minute. But let's start with listening to Prime Minister's questions, where the new Labour leader, Keir Starmer, tackles Boris Johnson, the Prime Minister, on care homes.
The Prime Minister says that solving the problem in care homes is crucial, but that can only happen if the numbers are understood. And therefore I was disappointed that the Prime Minister doesn't have an answer to the pretty obvious question as to what are those 10,000 unexplained deaths. Mr. Speaker, yesterday the overall figures given by the government at a press conference for those that have died from COVID-19 was 32,692, each one a tragedy. For many weeks, the government has compared the UK number against other countries. Last week, I showed the Prime Minister his own slide, showing that the UK now has the highest death total in Europe and second highest in the world. A version of this slide has been shown at the number 10 press conference every day since the 30th of March. That's 7 weeks. Yesterday, the government stopped publishing the international comparison and the slide is gone. Why?
Minister.
Mr. Speaker, as he knows very well, the UK has been going through an unprecedented, once-in-a-century epidemic, and he seeks to make comparisons with other countries, which I'm advised are premature, because the correct and final way of making these comparisons will be when we have all the excess death totals for all the relevant countries. We do not yet have that data. Now, Mr. Speaker, I'm not going to try to pretend to the House that the figures, when they are finally confirmed, are anything other than stark and deeply, deeply horrifying. This has been an appalling epidemic. What I can tell the House is that we are getting those numbers down, the numbers of deaths are coming down, the numbers of hospital admissions are coming down. Thanks to the hard work of the British people in reducing the R, Mr. Speaker, and reducing those numbers of fatalities, we are now in a position to make some small, modest steps to begin to come out of some of the very restrictive measures that we've had. I think people do understand what we're trying to do as a country, and as for the international comparisons that he seeks to draw now, I think he will have to contain his impatience.
So that's Boris Johnson, but he doesn't seem to have got the main point for some reason, which is that these figures don't really mean anything unless you compare them to population. I don't quite know why he didn't say that. Anyway, I mean, the figures around, looking at worldometers.info, they have a very good, I'll put a link up to this on our show page too, to the deaths per million of population. So for example, in the United States, they've got one of the highest, which is, highest totals, but not the highest per head of population. These things have lots and lots of things, like the density of the population makes a big difference. But the UK's figure is hovering around 500. Italy is higher at 520 per million, and Spain is higher too at nearly 600 per million. So anyway, these particular figures, James, Britain being the top of Europe, apparently, in the number of actual deaths. Would you agree that there's been a sort of a misuse of statistics in a way? Because it doesn't make sense to talk about a number only really as an average or a percentage of the population.
Yeah, I think Keir Starmer kind of pretty much hit the nail on the head there. And it was, you know, quite interesting to see Johnson really deflect from this idea that we shouldn't be comparing ourselves with other countries. Obviously, you know, the main figure is in some cases, I think, less meaningful than when you compare it to per population. So how many deaths per 100,000, for example, or per million. Making sure that we are comparing ourselves to other countries and saying, okay, what are they doing wrong? What are they doing differently? And also, where are they in their sort of cycle with this? How far behind are we or ahead of we, and what lessons can we learn? I think Johnson knows that the figures don't look brilliantly for him, and they show that we have not handled this as well as other countries. Yes, our country is different because, as Martin said earlier, we are much more of an international hub than many of these countries, and we do have, I think, in some cases, much more complex needs as a nation. But Mr. Starmer pointed out, it doesn't look good that he's all of a sudden now hiding these statistics, hiding these comparisons, not in the interest of public health and public awareness, but to save face politically.
Yeah. Martin, I suppose you'd agree with that. The statistics, though, I guess we can look at these statistics right now, but we've got really no idea how accurate they are, because, for example, some countries are doing a lot more testing, and obviously we'll find a lot more cases.
Well, that's right, and I think the most, and of course I agree that the obvious point to make to Johnson is you were putting these comparisons up every day, and now suddenly you've decided you don't want to. Why? I mean, if it was good last week, why don't you want to do it today? And of course, the obvious answer is because it looks bad. And of course, what's actually happening is a lot of policy, we suspect, is being run by the PR people, not by the medical people. And of course, if an inquiry will look into that and say, hang on a minute, the decisions you made there were for your own PR benefit.
But I would guess that some of those PR people will be nowhere to be seen. They'll have disappeared off the face of the earth.
Yeah, but the point is that that's the point of political accountability. If the government decides to go with PR rather than scientific advice, then they should be held. Their feet should be held to the fire for that.
Absolutely.
That's the minimum we demand of a competent government.
James?
No, I absolutely agree. We at the Lib Dems not only have been calling for this inquiry, which PMQs a few weeks ago, which Dominic Raab said wasn't going to happen, but we have been consistently saying, well, when you have these, whether it be for the easing of lockdown, whether it be for sending kids back to school, show us the evidence. If you want us to cooperate with these decisions that you're making, we have to have trust in you that you're making them for our benefit and not for your benefit, not for the benefit, as you say, of PR people saying, the public are getting a bit skittish about this. You need to take action.
Well, so if the government are going to block an inquiry, then it's up to us folks here in the press, the media, to do that inquiry, to preempt it, I suppose, and really to show the evidence that demands that such an inquiry has to take place. But I know one of the things which hasn't really been talked about much is the effects this is having on rents, both commercial and private rent. I mean, for example, many, many shops have been doing deals quietly to say to their landlords, well, we need a rent holiday. That means that we won't be paying rent at all for this period. And others are being told, well, OK, so you might have to pay it or you will have to pay it down the line. So this is incredibly important, but it's not really being discussed. I heard a really fascinating discussion on Irish radio about it this week. But what would you make about this, James Cox from the Lib Dems, your prospective parliamentary candidate for Bristol West, because it's almost like it's become taboo. We see all these buildings that would usually command massive amounts of rent, and there's really nothing being said about whether rent's being paid. It obviously isn't on those properties at the moment.
Well, I'm still paying rent on my property in Bristol, so for example,
Cabot Circus, you know. What's going on behind the scenes there? Because almost all the shops are shut. Does that mean that the landlords are still demanding rent? I don't think it does. They will be making arrangements so that they can at least make sure that some of their properties, the shops are still there when the lockdown opens.
No, absolutely. There will be arrangements made, and also there is a whole insurance industry that's built around these sorts of crises, which whether it be for, we found out with the pubs and with other sort of hospitality sector places, that if you cannot trade and you have this insurance, you can then claim back on that insurance.
Ah, but some of the insurance policies, James, will say, oh, well, if it's an act of God, you can't claim.
No, exactly. And there's been, I think, some people have been found short in this situation. And I think it's unacceptable that some shops might be forced to completely close forever and some businesses might just disappear off the face of the earth. Because from my point of view, the economy should sort of just be on pause at the moment. Because when all this is over or we start to taper the lockdown properly and we start getting businesses up and going, we're going to need an economy there. We're going to need businesses and shops to get running. Otherwise, we are going to experience, if we're not already going to experience, one of the deepest recessions since the Great Depression. So it's not in the interest of landlords, whether it be for businesses or for private renters, to make sure that they go bust during this period.
No, definitely not. I mean, the thing is, particularly for retail properties, for most people have seen that the retail sector is on its last legs anyway. You know, shops desperate for customers, you know, doing with these amazing discounts. And hasn't the high street been kind of dying off anyway?
Yes, the high street has been in severe need of, a rebirth for quite a long time. And it's been in massive decline for ages because of, you know, some things within the control of the government, some things not within the control of the government. But there has been, I think, a massive public policy gap in support for the high street for a while. I hope this doesn't kill it off, because the high street is massively important, not just for local economies, but for things like well-being, things like people being able to go into shops these independent places that would not survive online, but survive because they're on the high street.
Okay. What about the private sector, though? Because this is another side of things. You know, people trying to pay their mortgages, people trying to pay their rent, and simply find that there's no money coming in now.
In private housing, or?
Yes.
Yes. So the mortgage holiday, I completely support. I think it was a very sensible idea, and the government, I think, needs to be much firmer with the banking sector to ensure that those requests are granted and that the sort of the period is honoured. My main concern, going back to landlords, is that this isn't filtering down to tenants. Tenants, like myself, are still paying rent, despite the fact that there is a whole new system in place where if you own a property, you have a mortgage, you can, during this period, which I hope will be extended, you can get a bit of a holiday from it. There isn't that in place for the rented sector at the moment. So a lot of people are going to be ending up in rent arrears during this period, which means that there isn't going to be a blanket sort of policy. It's going to be dependent on...
What does the Bristol West MP, the Labour MP, Thangam Debonair, had to say about this? And do you think, you know, she's on the case there?
Well, she's come under a bit of criticism because she's also now the Shadow Housing Secretary for Labour. And she came up with her 5 proposals for dealing with rent during this period. And I think 4 of those proposals are actually quite reasonable. Things about, you know, extending the ban on evictions, lifting the cap on local housing benefits, the local housing allowance as part of the universal credit. Those things are very good. But on her policy on basically saying to renters, if you fall into arrears, you have 2 years of arrears to pay it back, which means that, say, if you're a part of this period, you're not paying rent, you can't pay rent for 6 months because either your furlough doesn't cover it or you're self-employed, and your housing benefit doesn't cover your rent, then you are, in my mind, you're giving people a debt bomb. You're saying you will now have to, once all this returns to normality, you're going to be paying not just your rent, but also the 6 months that you lost on top of that for a period of up to 2 years. And then what happens after that 2 years if you still haven't paid it off? So I'm very disappointed that Labour haven't taken this opportunity to, I think, be a bit more radical with the way that we look at not only housing in this country, but also welfare. They've rejected the idea of a universal basic income, which I think would fill a lot of the holes that have been... that are currently being shown up within our welfare system. But they've completely missed the mark on this proposal.
Martin Summers from the Labour Party. This doesn't seem really quite right, does it? Giving a rent holiday to people with mortgages and yet not doing the same for the renters because, as James is saying, many of them are living on the edge financially anyway. The idea that they will be storing up this massive amount of debt during this lockdown to be paid back in the future seems a little bit unrealistic and not very Labour.
Well, I have to agree. I think also the point about universal basic income is a good one. We should, after the 2008 crisis, have brought in a universal basic income. We didn't. And we're now paying the price for not doing it. But I seem to remember it was a Lib Dem Conservative coalition that was in power at that time, and they didn't do it. They should have done it. They wouldn't have done it because, of course, the Tories don't believe in it. Ultimately, the economic questions underlying all of this are going to be very, very powerful. We're not just talking about tweaking, about rents and things like that. There is probably going to be a banking collapse in the derivatives, stemming from the derivatives market further down the line here. What are we going to do when there's a banking collapse?
I mean,
I don't want to hear from the civil servants that we haven't got a plan.
Getting back to the point about Thangam Debonair, surely it's unrealistic of her to expect renters to be able to pay back the rent for this, whatever it is, 3, 4, 5, 6 months even, maybe, after the event. I mean, that's just not going to happen, surely, if people are on reduced incomes and possibly unemployed anyway.
Well, that's quite right. So, in other words, what's happening is people are still stuck in the past. BC, before COVID, And they're thinking in terms of the Overton window. If the audience knows what the Overton window is, the Overton window is what's acceptable mainstream politics. Now, of course, everybody has been caught short by this, so they're still playing the old thing. Oh, we must think about, we've got to think about, you know, how is this going to play in Middle England and all that sort of stuff. And in actual fact, what we really need is radical policies. And obviously the thing that we can unite around is a thing like something like universal basic income. I'm glad to hear that our Lib Dem colleague here is in favour of it. I'm in favour of it. The Green Party is in favour of it. Plaid Cymru are in favour of it. The SNP are in favour of it. And the only people who are against this are the Tories. And we've got to isolate them and we've got to bring it in.
Well, this whole idea of a ban on evictions is a good one too. Obviously, that maybe that should
absolutely
be kept for the whole of the rest of our lifetimes. But the problem there, Martin, is you may get landlords who, at the end of all of this, they just want to sell their property. And so as soon as this ban on evictions is lifted, there will be thousands or tens or even hundreds of thousands of people evicted.
Well, what happened to me in the 2008 crisis is that my landlord, who had hundreds of properties in Bristol, went bust. Because he basically overreached himself as a buy-to-letter. And that meant that everybody who were his tenants were all evicted. And it wasn't to do with the landlord being a bad landlord. He just disappeared. And the various other people bought the debt. And eventually I was kicked out. I managed to resist for quite a long time. But loads of other people I know were kicked out straight away. And that is going to happen. And that, of course, is then going to put people on the streets where they won't have an address, where they can't register to vote, and all the rest of it. There is going to be a massive economic recession. That is absolutely clear. And we're going to require radical policies to get out.
James Cox, because you are the prospective parliamentary candidate for Bristol West, Thangam Debonair is the sitting Labour MP and also Shadow Housing Minister. Do you think she's really thought this through? Because from what Martin's saying, you know, we could get an absolute avalanche of disaster as soon as this anti-eviction policy is lifted.
No, I think this policy hasn't been constructed, I think, with the tenants, whether it be in social housing or private housing, in mind as the how do we protect them. I think this is part of what I'm assuming is Labour's ultimate shift towards some form of electability, where they feel that they need to get back those Tory votes that they lost in the Red Wall and in the last general election. So it seems to be constructed more of, right, how do we protect landlords, not how do we protect tenants? Getting rid of but just going to your point on sort of, you know, what is acceptable. I think I give a bit of credit to the Tories here. They have pushed the boat out much further in terms of financial support packages than I think any of us ever thought they would. So there are things that I think they could do, such as lifting the cap on housing allowance, having an unlimited amount so that if you are, as part of universal credit, once you qualify for universal credit, all of your rent is covered, no matter what property you happen to be living in. That doesn't feel like much of a radical policy now because of how much support the Conservatives have given to those who are on mortgages, businesses up and down the country, that sort of thing.
Well, we'd soon have Daily Mail headlines then, wouldn't we, with the family with 20 children living in a castle on benefits. That will all start up again, won't it?
Yes, but I think, you know, a compassionate government can't govern by listening to the Daily Mail. It's got to do what is right for the, you know, the vast majority of people.
And if amen to that. Amen to that. Look, let's move on to just talk a little bit more about the lockdown and the way that Wales is now in a different kind of legal situation to we are here, which is just over the Severn Bridge. Suddenly you've got a different regime. I saw that there are a whole bunch of I think it was people, paragliders that come over to Wales from the West Midlands, and they were fined for going over there. So we've got a different system in Britain, in England than we have in Wales. So let's have a listen to the Prime Minister's questions clip and the question about that now.
We go down to Wales to Dr. Jamie Wallace. Dr. Jamie Wallace.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. May I congratulate the Prime Minister on being straight with the British people and spelling out a clear and cautious roadmap to lift the lockdown measures in England. Unfortunately, for my constituents in Bridgend, the Welsh Government has not set out any such plan or vision. Does he agree with me that the people of Wales deserve a government that is honest and clear with them about the road ahead?
Prime Minister.
I thank my honourable friend very much, and I will agree with him that, you know, but whatever the defects of the Labour government in Wales, my experience is that actually we've been working very well together across all four nations. We'll continue to do so, and my honest view is all those who talk about confusion or mixed messages are grossly overstating the position. The common sense of the British people is shining through this argument. They can see where we want to go. They can see where we need to go.
Martin, it sounds like the Labour government in Wales there's at least that was a Conservative MP there saying that there needs to be more clarity. They've said that we don't want to go with the English plan to slowly release the lockdown, but they haven't said what they do want to do.
Well, that's because the situation isn't clear. And when the situation's clear, you've got to be honest with people. We're not in position to relieve the lockdown. The pressure to relieve the lockdown is coming from, for example, the estate agents who want to restart the housing market. That's why the Tories have changed the messaging. They could have stayed with the same messaging, but they chose not to.
James, what do you make of this different situation on the two different sides of the Severn Bridge?
Well, I don't necessarily have an issue with regional variations or national variations of lifting lockdown because the situation is different in different parts of the United Kingdom. That's not what I think is the issue. The issue is that they're all looking at the same evidence, and Wales, the Welsh government, which is a Labour Lib Dem coalition there, is saying, well, you're trying to open, for example, the schools, whereas the Welsh Education Minister, the Liberal Democrat, Kirsty Williams, has said the situation hasn't changed enough for us to be able to send our kids back to school safely.
So you're going to have kids going to be. Yeah, I mean, it doesn't seem to be that these decisions are being made based on the medical situation and the extent of the virus. It's more political, and you could even argue that the different attitude in Scotland and Northern Ireland and Wales is basically is based not on medicine, but just on opposition to Boris.
I don't think so. I think anybody who is being seen to try and take political advantage of this is rightly being rebuffed by large swathes of the British public, because it is not the time to get political. It is the time to do what is fundamentally right in the protection of public health. And I think at the moment you've got Wales, Scotland and Northern Ireland looking at the evidence going, and I think most rational people who would have watched the daily briefings and will have watched the Prime Minister's presentation going, well, hang on, the situation hasn't improved enough for us to start shifting things. We can talk about having a roadmap. That's absolutely fine. I think actually it's beneficial to have a roadmap so people can see that there is going to be an end to this lockdown at some point. But the development that we've got here in England compared to the rest of the nations of the UK shows, for me, that these decisions are not being made in the interest of public health. They are being made in whatever political or PR interest, because they want Johnson to have been seen to, you know, be beating the virus, which is just not the way to approach the situation.
One of the groups which has been least, it seems, really thought about or talked about are the homeless over the last few years, but suddenly they are being cared for, they've been housed, and that came up at Prime Minister's questions too.
We now go over to Yorkshire to Julian Smith. Julian Smith.
Mr. Speaker, over 5,000 rough sleepers, 90% of the homeless population in the UK, are now in temporary accommodation as a result of action taken by the government at the start of this crisis. Will the Prime Minister commit to providing all funds necessary and all action needed to ensure that this positive dealing with the homelessness crisis can be made permanent and each of these individuals can be given a long-term home?
Minister.
Well, I thank my right honourable friend, and as he knows, it is this government's ambition to end rough sleeping by 2024, and it's great to see the progress that has been made even in this very, very difficult time. As he says, 90% of rough sleepers are now in accommodation or have been offered accommodation, Mr. Speaker, and we will be investing considerable sums to make sure that we build the housing and we address the social issues that tackle that problem for good.
Martin.
Well, I mean, obviously I agree that we should tackle the problem for good. It's just rather sad that it's taken a crisis like this to do what should have been done in the first place. Because, of course, homelessness has increased massively in my lifetime as a result of the suspension of building council houses, the sale of council house stock, the sale of social housing stock, all policies which were totally wrong and have created a massive social problem which we should never have got into in the first place. But hopefully, once you start doing the right thing, you can carry on doing the right thing. And, of course, that brings up bigger questions about the macroeconomic policy that the government's going to pursue, things like national debt, etc. I won't go down into the detail, but I will just mention that one of the things that's happening is that private companies are being bailed out in secret so that we don't know who's getting what bailouts. Massive. I've sent you stuff about this week, Tony. And, of course, also private companies are being brought in to do the testing and all the other stuff that's going on rather than local authorities. And I think that this government in particular is wedded to the free market ideology that's got us into this cul-de-sac. And that's a fundamental problem.
OK, James Cox, Lib Dem, can you give us your... I mean, because this is just seem amazing, doesn't it? It takes something like this for us to actually deal with homelessness, something which has been there really since the Thatcher years.
Yes, it is quite astounding how once we start treating things like genuine emergencies, how quickly we can, at least for now, find sort of a temporary stopgap within them. I do actually want to give credit to... the local council, which is a Labour run, for fantastic job they've done. I think it's 90% of rough sleepers are now off the street, which is absolutely brilliant. But this is, at the moment, only in times of crisis. And we do need to be thinking a lot more long term about how we can use this as an opportunity to end rough sleeping and homelessness in this country for good. I went to see Caring Bristol a few weeks before the lockdown started, and I asked them, you know, what is the one change in public policy that could really, really make a difference right now and immediately? And they said, and it goes back to what we were saying earlier about how to deal with the renters, lift the cap on the housing allowance as part of universal credit.
Nice to have these are the sorts of solutions which it seems that people with their financial interests have been pushing away. And maybe this will be the straw that breaks the camel's back, even though I don't know if it's quite analogous to talk about COVID-19 as a straw. But anyway, we saw this week at Prime Minister's Questions, our final clip is around the whole idea of green energy and whether that actually is going to play a part in all of this. So let's have a listen to that now.
We now go across to Ruth Edwards. Ruth Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Green investments generated the highest returns in the recovery from the 2008 financial crisis. As we restart our economy, will my right honourable friend commit to prioritising investment in low carbon infrastructure, such as the electric vehicle charge point network and renewable energy production, which will also help the UK meet its net zero target by 2050?
Prime Minister.
Yes, Mr. Speaker, and to encourage the take-up of electric vehicles, we are putting a further £1 billion into EV infrastructure across the country to prevent range anxiety for those who use EVs.
A reason I bring this clip in is because we've got this new film out from Michael Moore called The Planet of the Humans, which is really looking at this whole massive boom in green energy. As she says there, the highest returns for investors have come from this sector. The only problem is renewable energy isn't necessarily renewable. Much of the new energy plants, for example, are biomass, which can just simply be wood cut down from forests. And when it comes to, for example, having an electric car and charging it, well, that can come from any kind of power, including non-renewable energy like gas. Gas-fired power stations are the majority now in firing up the whole car electric charging system. So it's a bit of a convoluted way of getting to the point. But James Cox for the Lib Dems, is the idea that highest returns are coming from green energy, don't you think that there is an element of this which is a bit of a con, where some of this renewable energy, like wood, for example, is not renewable, and that an electric car isn't necessarily going to help if it's all fired by non-renewable energy?
Well, it's not a perfect situation, and I think we sometimes as environmentalists really damage ourselves by mistaking the good for the imperfect. Whereas, you know, if we're looking at, you have like for like a car run on petrol or diesel and a car run on battery power, electricity, even if that electricity further down the line is being powered by non-renewable resources, the emissions that it cuts is still significant. Now, if you can build, if we can use this opportunity to restart our economy and to really, you know, build a more progressive, compassionate and greener society, then I think you can begin to look at things in a new way. And if the government's main focus of the economy is going to be we need the highest amount of returns on our investments, then investing in green energy, investing in low carbon jobs is being shown to be the best way to do that. You know, when Lib Dems were in government, we created the Green Investment Bank, which as a result has quadrupled our renewable energy production in this country. But sadly, the government have since privatised that bank. So I think bringing that back into the public purse, so that it can really ensure that those investments that are going to have to be made to get our economy going and to make sure that we do have a green recovery, making sure that it is, that money is being properly sent to the right projects, which,
well,
as you said,
the Green Dems, I know, have published an article which is very critical of Michael Moore's latest film. And it does seem as if there is a certain inability to really take on some of the criticisms that have come across on this. I mean, as usual, Michael Moore is always stirring the pot in some new direction. But the idea that we're still looking for the highest return seems to be maybe the problem, even if it means cutting down forests in order to fire power stations.
Well, I think, you know, I haven't seen the Michael Moore documentary, so I couldn't comment on its accuracy. But it raises an interesting point that what we sometimes think of as a wholly renewable system, whilst we're building it, is not the case. And it's going to take, as you know, when you're completely revolutionising the way that a country is powered, it's going to take time to make sure you plug those holes. I think the criticism of it, of sort of highest investment, we could sit here and have a whole long debate. You know, I consider myself a green capitalist. I consider myself somebody who sees that the best way that we're going to be able to tackle the climate emergency is to sort of use capitalism almost against itself with the tools available. So we could have a whole long debate about whether or not that's the right thing. But right now, with this recovery, we're going to have a Tory government, and they are wedded to the free market in a much more rigorous way than most people are. So I think ensuring that they see the benefits from their point of view, which is, you know, more financially based, I think, than egalitarian based, then hopefully we all become a little bit better and we sort of win that battle together.
Martin, compromises may be being made here, mightn't they? So the idea is we want green energy, but we also want the highest return at the same time.
Well, I think I've read the critiques of Michael Moore's film by George Monbiot, for example, pointing out that hardly any Greens believe in biomass fuel.
Hang on. No, that's just not true. I mean, I know many that do. For example, Martin, eco-villages that have been set up around Europe, places I've visited that are all run on biomass. That is basically wood chips.
All right. I'm not going to argue with you. I think the bigger questions are, will the Tories do what's necessary to reboot the economy as we come out of this crisis? But I'm not sure we are going to come out of this crisis. The crisis has only just begun. There is going to be a further crisis in the financial services sector, and then the questions are really going to be asked about what our
priorities are. Okay, Martin, maybe you could just now say where you think we're heading, if you think we're going into further stages.
Well, what's going to happen now is there's going to be a collapse in the real economy all over the world. Let's just look at China. And then on the back of that, the derivatives market's going to blow up, as it did in 2008, and the banking system is going to collapse because we haven't got the resources to.
So what you mean? We're talking here about the casino economy also going down.
Yes. I mean, basically, with the QE has gone to the Federal Reserve in the US has basically merged with the Treasury, and they're printing money, any amount of money, just to keep the financial services sector going.
I can remember Mervyn King, the former governor of the Bank of England.
About what's going on in this country. Martin. In this country, Rishi Sunak is basically created a non-accountable mechanism for bailing out corporations which are in trouble, and we're not even allowed to know which corporations are being bailed out. And they definitely include BlackRock, which have been given the task in the United States, privatized from the Federal Reserve, which is in itself a private sector.
Funnily enough, BlackRock are majorly involved in green energy as well. But look, Mervyn King, the former governor of the Bank of England, after the 2008 crisis, said it was absolutely essential that the real economy is absolutely separated from the casino economy.
Well, that's exactly what hasn't happened since 2008. But the Federal Reserve was intervening in the repo market in the United States in September before COVID-19 appeared. Although, of course, the U.S. intelligence services had told the Israeli Defense Forces that there was a pandemic coming out of China in November, which is itself suspicious. There is going to be a major crash. And I expect the top civil servants in the Treasury here and elsewhere to be putting their thinking caps on. What are we going to do when the financial services system collapses? And if they haven't got a plan, I'm going to be extremely angry, because they've had a decade and a half to decide what they're
going to do. Well, alternatively, it might be the government that goes bankrupt and collapses, not the financial system.
Well, the individual countries, what's going to happen in local government here, because of what's happened with COVID, unless they come up with more money for local government, local authorities are going to go bankrupt, as they have in the United States. But the central government in the United States won't bail out local authorities. It's bailing out the financial services sector. And this is all going on while we're all talking about ventilators and so on. Behind the scenes, a massive transfer of wealth from the public to the private sector, which is essentially insolvent, is still going on. The banking system has always been insolvent since 2008. And everybody's presumed that it's all right. It wasn't all right. This is going to get worse. And
okay,
ultimately,
James,
we're going to have to change a lot of things.
Okay, James Cox, prospective parliamentary candidate for Bristol West. What do you make of Martin's, like, rather doom-laden scenario there, that actually we could be looking at something far worse down the line, with governments, maybe starting with local authorities, possibly even, governments themselves going bankrupt as part of the attempt to get out of this situation?
Well, Martin does paint a very, let's say not very hopeful picture, but I think a lot of it is based on actually quite grounded work. We didn't learn the lessons from 2008, particularly in the United States. There is still far too much of, as you say, the real economy and the casino economy being fed into each other. The legislation that was meant to happen to make sure there is separation never appeared, and quite a lot of that has also happened around here with Brexit and with sort of the economic cycle that we are due a recession. And I do fear it's going to be a particularly bad and nasty recession. So if we count that as, well, that's now unavoidable, it's going to happen, we have to decide as a country what we're going to do to come out of it. And I think I am worried about local authority funding. Because huge, particularly around things like adult social care, because at the moment there isn't enough money for it. Given another year, there's going to be a huge black hole and huge deficits in debt within local authorities, unless the government start funding them properly, and unless the government sort of decides that it's not going, revert back to an austerity agenda, and it does have a more sort of Keynesian investment driven. Recovery package.
Well, look, you mentioned Brexit there, and we're going to go and have a listen to. I've discovered another clip from Prime Minister's Questions. There have been pressure put on by the Germans this week, saying, "Well, look, it's just not realistic to have this negotiation complete by the end of 2020. You're going to have to extend it. You're going to have to delay Brexit, the actual negotiations, the trade deal negotiations, quite a lot longer." And I know both of you, Martin and and you, James Cox, Martin from Labour and James Cox from the Lib Dems are Remainers. What do you make of this? So let's have a listen after we've heard this clip then from Prime Minister's questions this week about the idea that maybe this is the opportunity to delay the negotiations, delay the Brexit, and although we've actually come out of the institutions, the political institutions, we're still part of the, for example, European Court of Justice and other. In fact, we are in a kind of limbo now. It's rather like Norway or Switzerland, where we're part of the system, the European single market, etc., but we're not part of the political institutions that decide the system. So anyway, let's have a listen to Prime Minister's questions. I'll hear from both of you after that.
Stuart Halsey, we go across. Stuart Halsey.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Both COVID and Brexit is suppressing trade, damaging jobs and the economy. And while we hope as COVID ends, global trade will bounce back, there's no guarantee that will happen quickly. The Prime Minister, though, could mitigate some of this damage by seeking an extension to the Brexit transitional period. Can he explain to the House why he's been so negligent in not seeking that transitional extension now?
Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I think one of the most remarkable things about, as I said actually to the Right Honourable Gentleman, one of the most remarkable things about this crisis has been the way the whole country has come together to deal with it. And there's been a spirit of unity and sharing that I don't think we've seen for a very, very long time. I think a lot of people in this country don't want to see the Brexit argument reopened. They want to see it settled. They want to see it done. And that's what this government intends to do.
Martin, what do you think of that?
Well, I think the obvious common sense, if you're talking about British common sense thing to do, is to extend the transition period. That's what all of our European partners want, so that we can negotiate our way out. If we don't do that, and I don't think they are going to do that, we're going to crash out. And then we'll have to work out what part of the hell we're in is to do with COVID and what part of the hell we're in is to do with Brexit. But it's
certainly not
going
to help.
So you
think it might be over to World Trade Organization?
Well, what's going to happen, Tony? I've been reading stuff this morning. It's going to cost for a single lorry to cross the channel with a mixed cargo. You need £100,000 worth of permissions. And that's just going to make that sort of transport.
I mean, that doesn't happen in most
organisations. You will see people line to get into the EU from Turkey into Greece. There is a massive queue of lorries every day. Hundreds of lorries queued up every day. It takes them days to get through. That's what's going to happen.
James Cox from the Lib Dems. Some people even saying that the COVID-19 crisis has been constructed in order to delay Brexit even further. But what do you make of the what you just heard at Prime Minister's questions there, the idea that maybe it's a good time to stretch it out?
Well, you know, I find the argument that we're trying to delay Brexit now or frustrate Brexit or whatever the argument is now that they've won the debate. We have left the European Union. We are no longer members of the European Union. What is up for debate now is, do we want to be part of the single market and the customs union? What sort of deal do we want? What sort of institutions do we still want to contribute to and be a part of? And I think personally, when the government's own models say that leaving the single market is going to create quite a significant suppression of trade, to then throw that onto the fire of what COVID-19 is doing and will continue to do to our economy, I think it's just a complete recipe for the disaster. Martin's correct. If you talk about British common sense, YouGov have shown that actually most people in Britain want this delay for the negotiations, because most people accept that, yes, we are leaving the European Union and these discussions have to happen about our future relationship, but they can't happen in the middle of a pandemic at a time when the new normal is still evolving and changing every day.
Can't they do these things on Zoom? I mean, that's what you and I have been doing, and on Skype and things like that.
It's not so much having the physical discussions and the negotiations. It's fundamentally on two things. One, I'd like to see us focusing our top civil servants on, the mechanism of government on the COVID crisis and sorting that. But secondly, we don't know what the world's going to look like in 6 months, a year, 2 years. And these are going to be hugely important negotiations that are going to have ramifications for decades and decades to come. Our relationship with our biggest single trading partner and how much of an open door we have, how much we close that door, the friction that we create with our trade, the frustration that we make, and the suppression to that such a key part of our economy.
So would you be happy for a few years for Britain to be stuck in this sort of Norway, Switzerland style, where we're in the single market still, but we don't have any MEPs and we don't have a place at the European Council, this sort of thing? So we're out of the political institutions, but we're still in the legal institution, the European Court of Justice, for example.
Well, happy you might be slightly overstating it, but I would be more content with continuing our situation, even potentially joining EFTA on a semi-permanent basis. I think would be a good outcome of the negotiations.
Could you just explain EFTA and what that is?
Sure. So EFTA is a collection of countries, including, I think, Norway, Switzerland, Liechtenstein and Iceland, which basically have a relationship with the EEA, which is, in a sense, the single market, where they have access to that, but they don't contribute to the political institutions of the European Union. So they don't, as you say, they don't have MEPs, but they do have different relationships with it. I've heard it referred to as sort of, you know, it's the common market, as it's membership of the common market in sort of in layman's terms. But that wouldn't be as bad. You know, ultimately I want us to be a full member of the European Union, but that isn't on the table. But the main argument here isn't in any way to frustrate our leaving or so people don't get the Brexit they want, but it's just not the time right now. We are in the middle of a huge crisis, as I say, which is going to have enormous ramifications. We can't begin to make these decisions, I think, when we're dealing with one fire already.
Okay, well, finally this week, we'll look at some research that we've done this week with a former physicist. He's now retired, living in Wales. From the Bristol University physics department. And he relates, his name is Dave Lawton. He was a physicist during the Cold War, and we'll be airing a full interview with him where he discusses some fascinating stuff going on here in Bristol with spies from the CIA trying to infiltrate his department at the university. Another fascinating thing we'll be having after in the second hour is looking at Klaus Fuchs, because he was the great nuclear spy that leaked the secrets of the atom bomb and the hydrogen bomb to the Soviet Union, and he actually got his degree here at Bristol University, amazingly. What Dave is pointing out is that there was a lot of research done, and this has a big bearing on the pandemic and the ethnic minority angle on it, because he says here that West Indians were discovered in the 1970s at the university to be severely lacking in vitamin D, which is one of those vitamins which the body uses to fight diseases.
I know one thing, and they're coming out, they're saying that a lot of the ethnic communities and the West Indian communities are dying because, you know, they're not, because of deprivation and stuff like this. Well, that's not true. It's because of lack of vitamin D. This has been known for years. Even in Bristol, my GP, John, knew it. He did a tests on the West Indian community in St. Paul's and found that they were lacking vitamin D. And this was 1970.
So that's Dave Lawton there, speaking to us earlier this week. He's retired now. He was a physicist up at the university. But what do you make of that, Martin? But it's possible that there are these basic deficiencies that some communities have because your skin, the actual colour of your skin and the pigment has a relevance to how much vitamin D it produces. If you're in a temperate country, but you've got black skin, you're not producing enough vitamin D.
Well, that may be true, but I think and certainly research needs to be carried out in this, because there clearly has been a big difference in BME communities.
Well, this is another one for the inquiry, isn't it?
Well, yes, it's another one for the inquiry. Don't forget that if you're BME, you're more likely to be a frontline worker on low pay because of the historical discriminations and so on. I'm pretty certain that it's going to be a complex answer, but it's pretty clear that from what's going on, that you know, there are people who are self-isolating at home in comfortable circumstances, and there are other people crowding onto tube trains. And that is the class analysis. That's the bottom line, isn't it? The haves and the have-nots.
Yeah, and people with cars, of course, who are generally wealthier people, are in an advantage, aren't they? Anyway, what do you make, James, of our little research, bit of research from the 70s from Dave Lawton there?
I mean, it's something I hadn't really considered. It's very interesting to hear. Whilst you were doing that, I did quickly Google to see if there was anything else on it, and there was a doctor who wrote a letter to The Guardian that got published in April talking about this as well. So I think, you know, it did, as Martin said, there isn't going to be a simple answer to this. But we have to accept the facts, I think, as they are presented to us, that there is a disproportionate amount of black and minority ethnic people who are dying of COVID-19, including those in the medical profession. Now, some of that, and I imagine quite a lot of that, as Martin said, will come down to the vast social disadvantage that, on average, more people in the BAME community have.
You're painting a picture here of basically white managers ordering black and minority ethnic people into the front line to fight the virus.
I don't know if I'd characterise it quite like that. But with what we are seeing is that those in high levels of social deprivation aren't being able to deal with the lockdown, whether that be from a health point of view or a social point of view or things like education and well-being, they don't have the tools to deal with it in the way that, say, some middle-class people do. And because of the discrepancy between race and class that still persists in the UK, that if you have my skin, I'm more likely to have gone to university, I'm more likely to be in a middle-class management job, et cetera, than if somebody from the black and minority ethnic community. So what I think is fascinating about COVID is that it is, whilst it is a completely tragic situation that we're in, it is unmasking, I think, a lot of the underlying social issues that have persisted for so long. And one of those, of course, is race in the UK. And it's, I think, a testament to how we do treat people of different races that we are seeing this. Now, there might be some biological reasoning behind it. I don't know. I haven't read the research, and I'm not in a position to make a comment there. It is interesting. But I hope the lessons that we learn from COVID, we do actually take action on, and we don't just sort of let them disappear with the virus.
Yes, a bit like the homelessness business too. Anyway, that was, you just heard there, that's the prospective parliamentary candidate for Bristol West, James Cox, and Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers will be back after this. Join us in a minute as we take our weekly look around the world.